Given that we only have one other member here right now, but welcome to Senate Elections and Constitutional Amendments. Today we have a pretty brief hearing, and I don't want to keep Senator Dodd waiting any longer. So before, we'll call the roll when we get a quorum, but in the meantime, Senator Dodd, are you willing to present to the subcommittee? Okay, great. So file item two is SCA 3, Senator Dodd. Welcome, and welcome, Senator Wolk. Lovely to see you.
Mr. Chairman and members, SCA 3 would lower the vote threshold to approve a locally issued bond for capital improvements for local libraries. California is an extensive network of local public libraries with 184 library jurisdictions and nearly 1,200 library branches. Data from 2014-15 shows that 21.6 million registered library users made nearly 160 million library visits that year. Our public libraries are vital and vitally important to our communities. Students, adults, seniors, people with vision and hearing impairments are among the many who frequent public libraries today. In addition to those lending books, libraries provide many other services, including internet access, study instruction, literacy training, just to name a few. The last time the state provided local libraries with capital assistance was in 2000, when the state issued a $350 million bond. Since then, library capital needs have grown to more than $4 billion. Local library jurisdictions are willing to go to the voters with local financing measures, and local library officials believe, as I do, that local library bonds should have the same voter threshold as school bonds, 55%. In many ways, our public libraries are extensions of our public school system. SCA 3 would simply ask the voters if they agree that local library bonds should be treated the same as school bonds. I believe that's a fair question to ask of our voters, and therefore I ask you for an aye vote to put this question on the next state ballot. With me this afternoon is Senator Lois Wolk, who has been a warrior for public libraries throughout her legislative career, and Napa County Supervisor Ryan Gregory.
Lois? Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here to support Senator Dodd's SCA 3 that would allow local measures for libraries to go to a 55% threshold, similar to community colleges and schools. The need has been described by the senator, and historically it's true. The last library bond that was put on the state ballot was Prop 14 in the year 2000. And I was appointed to the committee that actually dispensed the grants. And many of your libraries probably benefited, many of your communities probably benefited from that money then. That was only $350 million, and there has been none since. There have been efforts, but local communities, there were so many extraordinary and well-qualified proposals at that time. I can imagine how much more significant the need is now, because libraries are safe places for people in the community, and they provide extraordinary services from the very young to the very old. They're important community partners, and I think it's a reasonable request to ask the people whether they would like to reduce the threshold to the same as community colleges and schools to 55%. So I ask you to support Senator Dodd's bill, and thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Good morning, Chairman Stern and Senators. I'm Ryan Gregory, Supervisor from Napa County. Pleased to join my friend, Senator Bill Dodd, and the legend, Senator Lois Wolk. Napa County Board of Supervisors has taken a unanimous position of support for SCA 3. Here in Napa, we do so many great things at our library. I'll explain one of them. One of them is an online tutoring program for our kids that they get exclusively through their library card. I was really good at math. I became a civil engineer, but my kids got into pre-calculus and calculus, and I couldn't believe how much I'd forgotten. And the online tutoring that was available through the library for them was invaluable. And here are these kids who are at the cusp of keeping pace with their class or falling behind. And so for me, as educated as I was and as good at math as I was, I needed this online tutoring program to keep our kids on pace. So that's just one of the great things our Napa library does. We do believe that at this point, we provide such great wraparound services and very complimentary to our school district that when we do want to support and grow our library, we would like the same accommodation as our schools with this 55% threshold. So I'd encourage your support of SCA 3, and thanks for having us today.
Thank you, Ms. Supervisor. Any other witnesses in support here today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mike Dillon, representing the California Library Association, the sponsor of the measure. Has been pointed out, library usage just keeps continuing to grow and grow and grow. The need is huge, and we appreciate the committee's support. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Dillon, if I might follow up on that, what does growth look like these days in library usage? Do we have any...
I think Senator Dodd mentioned 160 visits, 24 million people using it, all types of new programs. My daughter Christina and I just learned of a new one the other day. The city of Ontario has a program called Lunch at the Libraries for low-income kids where they get their only good meal. This is during the summer. And then they also are learning to read while they're there. Those types of programs is what I meant when they keep increasing programs for veterans and whatnot.
People great.
Getting jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Dillon.
Johan Klaise, representing the City of Ontario. Mike mentioned the lunch program for students in the summertime. We are strong supporters of this, as libraries are really an extension of our educational system in California. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klaise.
Alan Smith on behalf of the Contra Costa County Library Commission, where in our community, if this measure had been in effect last year, two of our communities would have been well along the way to starting to build new libraries. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I can't say any more than that. Kathy Christian for the Contra Costa County Board of Supervisors, very much in support of the bill. Thank you, Senator Dodd.
Thank you.
Michael Radigan on behalf of the Board of Supervisors, Santa Clara County, in support.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Radigan.
Mr. Chairman, members, Paul Yoder, supervisor has NAPA covered today, but also on behalf of Solano County and their Board of Supervisors in support of the bill. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Any other witnesses in support? Witnesses in opposition? Mr. Wolf, looks like it's you.
We didn't see if I had any allies.
You're a force unto yourself.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members, good afternoon. David Wolf with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association in opposition to the bill. And members, I think primarily why we're opposed today is SCA 3 represents the erosion of the third rail of California politics, Proposition 13. It lowers from 2/3 to 55% the ability for libraries to pass local bond measures. And I think it's important to ask, why is that so important? And I think it's important because while all voters vote on these local bonds, only property owners pay them. Only property owners pay them. It reminds me of the analogy of democracy, and I'm sure, members, you've heard this one before. Democracy is two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for dinner, right? The sheep always gets screwed in that transaction. We don't want the sheep to get screwed, especially when you're talking about local bonds, right, that last for 30 to 40 years. Devastating, obviously, for property owners, and it's going to last far longer than, you know, the local government officials that put the bonds on the ballot in the first place. The sheep needs a voice. The taxpayers need a voice. The property owners need a voice. Especially since, you know, all people get to vote on these, but only property owners pay them. The bill also does nothing to ease the home ownership crisis in the state, and it's going to add to the 35% of the population because you're increasing below-the-line property taxes. It's going to add to the 35% of the population that can't afford a medium-priced home. So, I mean, for all of those reasons, just would ask for a no vote.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Any comments, questions from members of the committee? Mr. Anderson.
I don't have any at this point.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Allen. Quorum now? Should we take a moment? Let's take a moment to call the roll so that we can actually convene as a full committee if you'd pause for a moment.
Stern?
Here.
Stern here. Anderson?
Here.
Anderson here. Allen?
Here.
Allen here. Hertzberg? Leyva?
Okay, so now recognizing that quorum, I just would say briefly, happy to move this measure forward today. And I did want to point out, I think some of the concerns raised by Mr. Wolf are valid, but the reason I'm comfortable moving the measure forward is that I don't think we're answering that question as to whether to actually lower that threshold. The way I understand the framework of this proposed constitutional amendment is that that question would be brought to the voters. And maybe you could provide some clarity on that in your close, but we're not really pre-deciding the outcome of whether or not to lower that threshold. But if voters so chose to lower that threshold for themselves, then they could elect to do so. And I would also point out that I think there are other measures moving this session that sort of deal with this threshold question. So it'll end up being, I'm sure, an evolving conversation as to exactly what question would get asked of voters on this sort of threshold issue as we go forward. So with that, those are my quick comments, but I'd allow you to close.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely correct in your assessment. This is what we want to do is allow local communities that have these incredible needs and desires and, you know, for helping their youth and also helping adults as well, the people that use these libraries, move forward. And I respectfully ask for aye vote.
So the motion, we need a motion to move the bill. And Senator Allen has gone off for a tie? Does he need it? Something like that? Yeah, we saw him.
I will give a courtesy motion to keep the committee moving along. And I certainly love libraries, but I won't be supporting this today because I believe that this will be passed by a simple majority to take two-thirds away from voters in the future. So if this was being passed with a two-thirds, it'd be more acceptable, but that's not the case.
All right, we have a motion from Senator Anderson. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Motion is due pass. Stern?
Aye.
Stern, aye. Anderson?
Nope.
Anderson, no. Allen? Hertzberg? Leyva?
We will leave that measure on call. Thank you, Senator Dodd. Thank you, Senator Wolk. Lovely to see you again. We do not think we have Mr. Allen back. Mr. Allen.
If technically this is part of the floor, if they consider 3191 part of the floor because it's connected to the floor, so you have to... Have
violating it. Protocol. Yeah. Welcome back, Senator Allen. You look dapper today, I have to say.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
Really good-looking tie there. We have before us file item...
We're all wearing...
One. Yeah, you copied us. Senate Bill 235. Senator Allen, welcome.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate your time and attention to this important matter, SB 235, which ultimately seeks to prevent misleading ballot designations for judicial races by requiring candidates for judicial office to use their official job titles if they're employed by a public entity. So currently, California law allows candidates for judicial office to write their own ballot designations using three words, unless, of course, they're already hold elective office, and then, of course, they can use the full title. According to code, this ballot designation is designed to describe the candidate's, quote, principal professions, vocations, or occupation. Now, ballot designations are very important. We know this. We've all run for office here. But, you know, I think they're especially important in the context of judicial races because those elections are nonpartisan. So there's no mention on the ballot of where they may stand politically. And then, of course, they're oftentimes these candidates are among the least known on the ballot. They typically, you know, raise less money for races, and it's difficult for judicial candidates to kind of break through. And so voters end up making their decisions based on sometimes very little information, that ballot designation that they see on the ballot. Now, the California Code of Judicial Ethics does prohibit candidates for public office, for judicial office, from engaging in any kind of campaign activity that is inconsistent with the integrity of the judiciary. There's sort of a higher standard for the judicial races. Now, integrity is further defined as fairness, honesty, and soundness of character. But you know, you certainly do see a lot of cases in LA County. I think we see some of the most egregious examples of candidates who, you know, choose designations that emphasize or indeed sometimes exaggerate their experience, their purported experience in punishing criminals in the chase for votes so that they can show that they're tough on crime. So you have situations where people are using increasingly hyperbolic titles. Prosecutors are using increasingly hyperbolic titles to describe what they do for the purpose of their ballot designation. Now, this situation, I believe very strongly, has not served the public interest. One candidate was accused of delaying a settlement in a domestic violence case merely to justify her ballot designation so that she could put domestic violence prosecutor on the ballot when she was running for judge, because she wanted to be able to say, if challenged, that she had done domestic violence work in the course of the last year before she ended up running for the judge. The judicial position. And so she literally delayed the settlement to do that. Another recent judicial election, 3 out of 5 candidates were forced to change their titles after rivals claimed that their titles misled voters. It created a whole hullabaloo. But in one case, the ruling basically forced someone to move from gang murder prosecutor to gang homicide prosecutor. The judges are struggling with how to deal with this area of law. Some ballot designations have also misled voters in other ways. In an election between a supervising criminal prosecutor and a gang murder prosecutor, a voter would likely deduce that the supervising criminal prosecutor supervised the gang murder prosecutor, but this was not the case. And in fact, in one case, it was exactly the opposite. So we're trying to get a handle on this increasingly hyperbolic issue so as to allow our voters more information and a less manipulated experience when they're trying to choose who to vote for judge. Now, let me mention that I'm appreciative of the comments of the analysis, and I want to say I went through the analysis carefully over the last couple of days, and I think that all three of the issues that were raised by the analysis on page 5, I want to address. First of all, the issue of making, you know, asking whether it's appropriate to force government attorneys to identify on the ballot as part-time, I think we ought to drop that requirement. I also think that we should allow anyone who is working as an attorney to identify themselves as attorney, lawyer, counselor at law, if that's what they choose to do. They wouldn't have to say deputy district attorney if they didn't want to use that ballot designation. And then in addition, I want to make sure that government attorneys, so both government attorneys could do that, but also candidates who are in the private sector could use any of those three appellations if they're, you know, licensed to practice law in California. I think that would be appropriate to allow them to use one of those three designations. So we're going to get those fixed. I've talked to committee staff a little bit about this. This bill is going to Judiciary Committee and will be before Judiciary Committee next week if it gets out of committee today. And I'm committed to working through those issues. But I think this is ultimately about trying to provide more fair information to voters when they're voting for judge. And with me today, I've got Judge Randolph Hammack, who's from the LA Superior Courts, and also Larry Doyle, who's from the California Conference of Bar Associations.
Thank you, Senator.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, first of all, I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. I know this might be the most glamorous or hot topic issue, but it's important, I think, to all citizens in the state of California. I certainly take it serious. I just want the record to reflect, speak like a lawyer or a judge, that I'm appearing here in my personal capacity only. I bore my own expense, paid for my own out-of-pocket. I'm not asking for any reimbursement from the court, from anyone. I took my own personal time. I cleared my calendar. I just want to make sure everything about this is on my personal endeavor. I'm not representing the viewpoints of the Los Angeles Superior Court, which is the largest trial court in the world. We almost have 500 judges. the L.A. Superior Court. I'm not representing the viewpoints of the California Judges Association, even though I'm on the Judicial Elections Committee. I'm representing my own personal views. Also, as a sitting judge, I have to be very careful what I say. And so I've looked into the ethical considerations. And judges, there's an exception. Judges are allowed to comment on issues that affect the, quote, administration of justice. So I actually got ethics opinions, which allowed, which I felt very comfortable that I could speak today. So, all right, so here we go. 2 points. Constitutional issues. There's been some discussion of maybe this is raised as some First Amendment issues or First Amendment concerns. There is a, first of all, there is really no legitimate constitutional issues involving ballot designations. The state has been regulating ballot designations for decades and decades. There's no First Amendment issues. There was a recent Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court case, Williams-Uley versus Florida Bar. It basically says if a state allows for judicial elections, because some states don't, we doesn't mean we have to treat judges or judicial candidates the same as we treat politicians. States may impose stricter regulations in judicial elections because there's a compelling state interest in promoting truth and honesty and, moreover, promoting greater confidence by the public in judges and judicial systems. In other words, judicial elections are unique and separate and distinct from all other types of elections. So, and I want everyone to know, in terms of the legislators, SB 235 will not affect any other type of legislation. It only applies to Superior Court judges. And so no one should really have any concerns in the Assembly or in the Senate that somehow this is going to affect their ability or their opponents in for future elections for themselves. Point two, the current framework simply doesn't work. Yes, you can file a writ for something you feel is, quote, misleading. But here are the facts. The current law is too vague and too ambiguous. And it allows for these types of shenanigans or gamesmanship. These writs have to be filed in exactly 10-day window during the viewing period. And literally, they are heard literally the day of or several days before the ballots have to be printed. So what happens? You avail yourself of a writ. It gets heard. A determination is made by one of my colleagues in writs and receivers. We have three of them. And then there is no appeal. Really, there is no effective appeal. And that's why, because it becomes moot. The ballots are being printed. Okay, and it's going to have the three names. We're not going to recall the 4.9 million ballots things of that nature. It would cost millions of dollars. The typical position of the county registrar is, we don't care. Choose which one you want. We just want to get the ballot printed. Please give us a decision, because it's going to cost us literally millions of dollars, okay, if we have to delay. So that's something to be concerned about. And there's this one example, if I may beg your indulgence. This is the one that's never come up. It's my favorite. Los Angeles prosecutor, initial cap, Los Angeles prosecutor. The acting city attorney back in 2009 or 2010, when he ran for DA in 2010, a contested election, which Jackie Lacey won, he put the title Los Angeles prosecutor. He was the actual city attorney. 20% of his office involves prosecuting misdemeanors. You know, there's an argument that that's something that he does. It got shot down on the writ, okay, saying it was misleading because a judge found that it makes people think that he might be the prosecutor for the county of Los Angeles. 4 years later, an attorney, a maritime lawyer, I didn't even know that maritime lawyers existed anymore. He practiced maritime law. He put Los Angeles prosecutor, the same exact designation. It got challenged by a writ. He argued he was a volunteer city attorney, where you pay money to the city attorney to train you to allow you to try a misdemeanor DUI or prostitution case. He actually tried the case in front of me, okay? He was competent, good guy, older guy, experienced, and he was allowed to use that designation. So here's the point. Different judge, different result. Okay, and his boss couldn't use it. I mean, that's how absurd this can be. All right, so I know I've used up my time. I feel very strongly about it. I've studied this for almost 20 years, and the core problem, and it's not easy to fix, but you start with the genesis where we can actually have an objective standard that's fair. You are a deputy district attorney. You are a deputy public defender. You are a deputy attorney general. That's who you are. You know, you should be proud of it. You should run on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Hammack, and thank you for your decade of research and work leading up to this, because it truly is the culmination of all that work, so we do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. And let me just say, while Judge Hammack was obviously being very careful about stating this was only his own personal opinion, the California Judges Association has weighed in strong support of the bill, and I have the letter here if folks want to have an opportunity to read it.
You also have Mr. Belote.
Well, I'll follow up on that. Thank you, Mr. Doyle. I'm Mike Belote on behalf of the California Judges Association. This is not an issue that judges take lightly. There's actually very intensive debate about should there be a bill and how should you fashion the bill. Judge Hammack is right. This has gone on too long. There are too many subjective evaluations going on. The analysis indicates the level of creativity that candidates have used. It is true one can challenge the designation by writ, but we shouldn't encourage judicial actions if we can have simple, straightforward rules. So we've worked with Senator and his staff on some of the fine-tuning, the part-time and that sort of thing. We think the bill deserves to go forward. We support it. We think it's an important objective. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belote.
Larry Doyle on behalf of the Conference of California Bar Associations. We're the sponsors of the bill, but I believe that the other witnesses have pretty much covered the waterfront. We're just simply think that it's necessary. Judicial elections should be pretty much simple and straightforward. It's a different kind of animal, and it really requires something that is, you know, simple and honest and something you don't really want to start ranging out into hyperbole. So, as for your support on this important bill, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Any other witnesses in support? Seeing none, any witnesses in opposition?
Good afternoon, Mr. Senator, Chairman, Mr. members Hertz. Of the committee.
Welcome.
My name is Bradley Hertz. I'm a partner at the Sutton Law Firm, and we practice campaign and election law. Part of that is, of course, advising judicial candidates, incumbents, as well as challengers on ballot designations. I definitely agree the system is not perfect, but I don't think that this is the answer. My first concern is the Equal Protection Clause. You have, even though there may not be First Amendment concerns, you are here treating one class of candidates, professional government attorneys, differently than you're treating private attorneys. And I could see this having effects that we really wouldn't want. So, for example, a deputy district attorney who handles domestic violence and now might have been able to say domestic violence prosecutor will be stuck with deputy district attorney or something to that effect, whereas a defense attorney who defends those accused of domestic violence could say domestic violence attorney or domestic violence litigator. So I think you may end up that the remedy doesn't quite resolve some of the issues. I also don't think the system is as broken as it's made out to be. You know, there are certainly the cases that boggle the mind occasionally, but largely there is a self-regulating aspect because there's a detailed ballot designation worksheet that has to be submitted where the candidate demonstrates why he or she thinks it's a proper demonstration. The Registrar of Voters is required to reject anything that is false or misleading. And those ballot designation worksheets are made publicly available for that window of opportunity to bring a writ. So there's often administrative advocacy that goes on trying to convince the county council and the registrar why something's false or misleading. The candidates have their own disincentive to cheat because it could get rejected, they could get sued, et cetera. And then you have, if administrative advocacy fails, writs of mandate. They're very few and far between, relatively speaking. They're very quick and dirty, to use the legal term. And usually the judges get the right answer. So I believe that there are some very good aspects of the bill. The John Eastman situation, for example, where someone running for attorney general was appointed to a position in South Dakota and then used assistant attorney general without stating California. So I think it's important to state the geographical area you're from, but I do think that this really puts the thumb on the scale against prosecutors in favor of others, whether they be incumbents or civil attorneys. I do think there are a few other ways that this could be improved. One could be looking at expanding the three-word limitation. I've had many times where judges have told me my hands are tied. We've only got three words. So, for example, when Paul Bacigalupo ran and was a judge of the state bar, and that was litigated to the Court of Appeal in an unpublished decision, Moses versus McCormick, he was judge, comma, state bar. Well, if we had more words, he might have been judge of the state bar. In this case, we're now maybe going to have to refer to the official administrative agency, which I think is a good thing. If you're a workers' comp judge, that's different from a different kind of administrative law judge. So I definitely think there are some good aspects. I think there are some more things that could be clarified that I put in my April 26th letter dealing with the calendar year, the look-back provision, and others. But I really think that the meat of limiting what a prosecutor can call him or herself on the ballot would run into some real problems.
Thank you, Mr. Hertz. And welcome, Senator Hertzberg. I wanted to give Senator Allen a chance to respond, but I also, if there's any comments or questions from the members, I'll open it to you all first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Senator Allen for bringing the bill forward. I think that the more transparency we can create so that people actually have an idea, three words is very difficult, but that we can actually have an idea on what we're voting on and what this person actually does is helpful. And so I think this is a good transparency bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Leyva. Senator Hertzberg?
I just want to say that Mr. Hertz is my lawyer.
Oh, really?
Not on ballot designation issues,
Not on ballot designations, but on other issues.
That's so funny.
He has been my lawyer on many occasions on various things. And also, I appointed Paul Bacigalupo to that job back in the old days. But is this really, I wouldn't ask this question, but for the fact that it's Senator Allen is the author, because he'll contemplate this. At some level, what happens, the game that gets played is pollsters test different ideas, yeah. Right, and what yeah. sounds the best. No one really knows. I mean, all of us who are around in government, we get friends, calls from our friends, like, who are these judges? Can you help me, right? They always ask that question, mm-hmm. no matter whether we're a lawyer or not, because we're in politics. Can you help me? Because I have no idea what to say. And then if it says child molestation prosecutor or whatever, oh, well, I want for the prosecutor, I'm tough on crime or whatever, and they play those games. Now, that's true. But aren't we really putting a thumb on a scale in favor of incumbent judges by virtue of this limitation, Mr. Allen? I mean, because there's two sides to the trade. One side, you can argue, oh, well, you know, you got all these funny things that people are playing the game. When you're a judge, right? And so judges, any incumbent, whether you're senator running for re-election in Santa Monica or whether you're a judge, I mean, at some level, I don't understand it, but incumbents seem to have an advantage. So are you, by creating this limitation, aren't you putting a thumb on the scale in favor of incumbent judges?
I know that the judge has a comment about this too, but ultimately I think that these titles have gotten so out of control and they're so beyond the title that we all know that these prosecutors have that we're trying to rectify that situation. I don't think there's any deputy district attorney is not going to be something that's going to be frowned upon by the average voter when they look at the ballot. So I'm not sure that they're going to, I don't think that's going to be a harmful ballot designation for a prosecutor to have. I just want to make sure that there's not this sort of ridiculous hyperbolic race to the bottom where everyone's trying to come up with the most hardcore sounding. I mean, let me put it this way. So between 06 and 16, there were 41 deputy district attorneys who were candidates for Superior Court judge, and only one of them used deputy district attorney. The other 40 were things like hardcore gang prosecutor, sex crimes prosecutor, child molestation prosecutor, violent crimes prosecutor, sexual predator prosecutor, government corruption prosecutor. And this is sometimes based on maybe one case that they did. That seems so much more manipulative than any change that we'd be making with this bill. So,
I've done some of these writ of mandate cases for people over the years, you know, when you have the challenges for various reasons. And they're interesting cases, you know, because what's his face? There was the old legislator here in Sacramento who used to handle all those cases.
Terry Friedman?
Oh. Terry. No, that's in L.A., but up north he handled all these cases. No, he was a member. Lloyd Conley. Thank you very much. From the old days. He's great. He's retired now, isn't he? Jeez. So he's a really young guy. I guess that happens. But he'd handle those. But judges really are clueless about trying to handle these things. I've gone in and I guess mine was in L.A. with Luis Caldera. But so that's the flip side. You're still going to get these things challenged. So what do you do? Well, I mean, guidance to the judges. Maybe Hertz is right. Maybe four or five words might be better given the circumstance.
Well, at least under the bill as written, they would just use their title. By the way, I will mention that the vast majority of competitive judicial elections are not between a sitting judge and a challenger. They're almost always for an open seat between two candidates who are trying to attract more attention. They're very rare that there's a sitting judge challenge, and it's usually because they have an ethnic name. I hate to say it, but you know those cases.
Indeed.
But I'm, you know, I mean, I'm happy to.
Tell that to Senator Janet.
You're on Judiciary Committee. This will, I mean, if it gets out of committee today, we'll be up next week. We could talk about tweaking this.
Okay.
Yeah, I know the judge has a comment you want to make.
I just think it's interesting. It's an interesting issue, and I'm smart. I ascribe to the sentiment that Senator Leyva mentioned. It's an important issue. It's so ticklish.
Yeah.
How do you deal with this stuff, you know? And at some level, it has kind of been a race to the bottom on the one hand, but on the other hand, these are hard decisions for voters to make, right?
Well, the other thing is, I should mention, and this is to be responsive to Mr. Hertz, he says, well, does it put the thumb on the scale for judges? The other question is, what about for private sector attorneys? Now, the Judges Association actually brings up this issue, and I just got the letter. I'm trying to grapple with how to incorporate this, but they said, well, with regard to private sector candidates, we recommend that the measure also provide an option for a candidate who is allowed to use the designation of attorney or lawyer to designate a generic area of law in which the candidate engages in a primary area of practice, such as family law attorney or criminal law attorney, subject to the three-word limitation. This would decrease the possibility of embellishment by private sector candidates and appropriately focus the title on the candidate's relevant practice area. I'm interested in maybe us trying to work together on some language that would sort of meet the goals the core concern you've raised, the goals that have been raised by the Judges Association in their letter to make sure that there's not unfairness with vis-a-vis private sector attorneys. And I'm very happy to talk through language on that, too.
So I think we'll go to Judge Hammack for a quick comment. And yep.
He raises an interesting point. Does this put the thumb or on the scales on behalf of judges? Frankly, we have the safest job in the world. We have a 99.8% retention rate since unification. I've done the numbers. Only 1,257 races since unification in L.A. County. Two judges lost. All right. I include Pierce and Zintra, two judges. Since 1988, the last time before Zintra, Janoffs, was a judge, Roberta, what was her name, Roberta? In 1988, she lost. That was the judge before that. And she put incumbent. That's why she lost. So judges rarely get challenged. We have historically about a 2 or 3% challenge rate, 2 or 3%. And even then, we win 99% of those. So this, I want to be clear, this is not, my support is not to protect judges. Far from it. Frankly, we don't need the protection, right? The public needs the protection because they're getting emboldened. It just morphed. It started with criminal prosecutor, then it went to hardcore prosecutor, hardcore gang, and now you're out in the stratosphere. You know, like I wrote in the LA Times a year ago, my prediction is ISIS terrorist prosecutor next time. Okay?
Right.
So that's my comment.
Noted. Thank you, Your Honor. Senator Anderson.
I just, having listened to all the testimony, I just want to remind you that when these things are challenged, they go before a judge. I find that ironic that we now have to make laws because judges can't make prudent decisions, and that you have one judge ruling one way without looking at what the past is. And perhaps if this bill was about training judges to be more professional on this issue or more knowledgeable, I could support it. But I don't want to take away or so narrowly define things that we lose discretion. And I think that the judges that hear these cases should be better trained. Clearly, in the case of the L.A. prosecutor, that was so outrageous, that judge should be reprimanded for that decision, in my opinion. It's just nonsense. And I'm not going to keep changing laws to chase bad judges. I think we should put the focus on giving them the training necessary so they don't make such foolish decisions. So I won't be supporting it today. I appreciate the issue and the problem, but I think ultimately the judges need better training, because this is, when I look through it and I think about all the things that have been challenged in San Diego, and, you know, we have a great deterrent. When you lose, you pay, and you pay a lot. So people don't want to have to waste their campaign funds on the other attorney fees. They don't want to waste the funds on all this stuff. They would rather have voter contact with those funds. So we have a huge deterrent. Our problem is not the law. Our problem are the judges who hear these cases. So I apologize, because I'd like to be more supportive. You're an outstanding senator, and I enjoy these conversations with you. But I think that we have to stop with the Band-Aids and focus on the real problem.
And all I would say with respect, Senator, is that the very issue you're talking about is perhaps exacerbated by the fact that we elect our judges based on these manipulative ballot titles, and that that's what actually determines whether they get onto the bench or not.
Good answer.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Allen. I would appreciate you committing to work through some of the issues raised in the committee analysis.
100%.
And the timing is such that we can't amend the bill in committee today, but in the next committee, I'll be sitting in Judiciary as well reviewing this. So appreciate working on that, as well as seeing if we can't tease out some resolution on, I think, the concern on equal protection, mm-hmm. maybe dovetails with this question mm-hmm. of more accurate characterization of
the private sector.
Sector. So.
Yeah.
Open to some solutions on that. I don't really have anything clever off the top of my head for how to do that. I'm a little reticent, to be honest, to break the seal on three words, but willing to consider it. But those constitutional questions are probably more appropriate for the Judiciary Committee, so we will look at those in more detail there. But as a matter of elections law here today, I think the measure hopefully starts to sober up the judicial election process in a way that I think is befitting of this branch of government. It is not, does not, ought not, and ideally won't sort of carry with it the same political stridency, the same, as you both mentioned the word hyperbole, that extra politicization that I think does get dangerous, especially in a state like ours where we do elect the judiciary. I do want to accurately recognize the experience that a prosecutor has had, yeah. But as Judge Hammack pointed out, I think there ought to be, the public should be honoring. I think there's nothing wrong with standing up and saying, I'm a deputy attorney general. Or I'm a LA City prosecutor, or whatever it may be. So I think that there's merit in that sort of a cooler approach here. So that's why I'm going to be supporting the bill today. And I would love when we get over to Judiciary to be added as a co-author, because I think that, I think that it needs to happen.
Move the bill.
Very good. Recognize a motion due pass to Senate Judiciary. Secretary, please call the roll.
Stern.
Aye.
Stern, aye. Anderson. Anderson, no. Allen.
Aye.
Allen, aye. Hertzberg.
Aye.
Aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Thanks. Leyva, aye.
Very good. And while we have a full committee here, I'm going to open up the roll on the proceeding matter of file item 2, SCA 3, which is a due pass. Secretary, please call the roll.
Allen? Aye. Allen, aye. Hertzberg?
Aye.
Hertzberg, aye. Leyva?
Aye.
Leyva, aye.
Very good. With that, we will commence the hearing. Thank you, Mr. Hertz, Senator Allen, and all parties involved for attending. And this meeting is adjourned.